You're going to love this. Just love it.
Yep. Stuck in the Middle with You from Pacifica Radio's KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. This is the broadcast, as heard on 90.7 FM, coast to coast and around the globe on kpfk.org, and 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all around swell fellow from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us for another thrilling action-packed adventure. We've got some breaking news concerning South Carolina, and in a few minutes we will also be speaking. It's not just on the Republican side of the equation that there is discord. We've been talking about a lot of discord, of course, since Donald Trump has entered the race and changed my life, really, for the better. Have I mentioned that?
I think he's changed a lot of lives, yes, in the media and entertainment and comedy.
It was a dreary couple of weeks until Donald Trump got in, and now everything is better.
Are you going to start singing "You Light Up My Life"?
I might. But it's not just on the Republican side that things are a mess. We'll talk about the Democrats in a little bit, and we talked a little bit earlier this week about what happened over the weekend at a progressive conference out in Phoenix. Well, the woman who led a very lively progressive Black Lives Matter protest against Democratic presidential candidates Martin O'Malley and Bernie Sanders over the weekend at that conference, she will be here to discuss that. Tia Oso of the BlackAlliance.org group. To discuss that and the controversy among progressives that have come along with those protests. We'll talk about that in a little bit. And we got some other news about Democrats and the presidential race shortly. But this just in, breaking, Dylan Roth. And yes, as I understand, that's how you pronounce his name. Roth, not Roof. Happy to change that if I learn otherwise. But Dylan Roth, the man who is said to have confessed to the 9 murders at the AME church in Charleston, South Carolina in June, has now been charged with 33 federal counts, including federal hate crimes charges, on Wednesday. This was announced by Attorney General Loretta Lynch. She said Dylan Roth sought out African Americans, in particular the African American church, Emmanuel AME, because of its historic significance. She said to carry out these twin goals of fanning racial flames and exacting revenge, Roth further decided to seek out and murder African Americans because of their race. An essential element of his plan, however, was to find victims inside of a church, specifically an African American church, to ensure the greatest notoriety and attention to his actions. Attorney General Lynch said no decision has been made yet whether to seek the death penalty or not. So hate crimes is part of what he has now been charged with, 33 counts, not terrorism, it seems, however. And this is just breaking. I haven't gotten a look at the charges themselves, but I don't understand. Maybe I just don't understand the difference between hate crimes and domestic terrorism, because this sure as hell seems like domestic terrorism to me. If you look at 18 U.S. Code Section 2331, it defines domestic terrorism for purposes of Chapter 113B of the Code, entitled Terrorism, defines domestic terrorism this way. It says activities with the following three characteristics. One, involve acts dangerous to human life that violate federal or state law. Obviously, that one is clear. Two, appear intended to intimidate or coerce a civilian population. And three occur primarily within the territory jurisdiction of the U.S. So those are the three things, the three characteristics. And I guess the one in question here was this act intended to intimidate or coerce a civilian population? Well, we know, according to reports, and, you know, Loretta Lynch obviously knows this case better than I do. But according to reports, he had a witness said that he had left one of the people alive in this church so that she could tell the story to others. That would seem to be meant to appear to intimidate or, frankly, coerce a civilian population. And then if you look at this guy's manifesto that he posted online before he pulled off this massacre, some terribly ugly things in it, and I won't give you the worst of it, but as to coercing a civilian population, he writes, "Who is fighting for these white people forced by economic circumstances to live among Negroes? No one, but someone has to. It is far from being too late for America or Europe. I believe that even if we made up only 30% of the population, we could take it back completely. But by no means should we wait any longer to take drastic action. We have no one doing anything but talking on the internet. Well, someone has to have the bravery to take it to the real world, and I guess that has to be me." You know, I don't know. To me, that sounds like someone who is trying to coerce the civilian population, to coerce a, you know, a political outcome in this matter. Another section of here, this defines domestic terrorism as to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion, to affect the conduct of government by mass destruction, assassination, or kidnapping. So I don't know. And to be frank, it's not like I want more charges against this guy. He's got 33 charges, hate crimes included, which allows him to be put to death by the government if he's found guilty, if they so choose to seek the death penalty. But it just seems terribly disturbing to me that, you know, terrorism is used in certain cases, but not others. Is you know, the shooting last week in Chattanooga was, you know, immediately declared to be a possible domestic terrorism, but not this. I don't get it.
Well, as I mentioned when the Chattanooga shooting first came out, and I really was meaning it off the cuff, it did seem to be directly related to the race or ethnicity of the shooter and the race or ethnicity of the targets and the location.
The fact that they were saying that this was a potential terrorism.
Right. Immediately, right off the bat, in the Chattanooga Navy recruitment station shooting. And yet for this, for the South Carolina Charleston church shooting, that was not the case. And it still apparently is not the case. It does seem to be focused directly on, and that's, you know,
if you have a Middle Eastern name and you commit
terrorism,
a crime, then it's terrorism.
And
anybody
if you
else?
Don't, then it's not.
Right. I know. That's what it seems to come down to. And that is
something I think the Department of Justice needs to address.
I think so. But here you have the Department of Justice, the head of the Department of Justice, Attorney General Loretta Lynch, saying, nope, not terrorism, hate crime. Okay. Clearly it was a hate crime. But, you know, what is domestic terrorism then? I guess I don't get it. All right. We will look into that as the days and months go on, I suspect. Getting back for a moment to the discord in the Democratic Party, what I wanted to talk about, wanted to bring out, you know, we've been talking about the polls. We've been talking about Donald Trump soaring in the polls now by a long margin, huge margin now, defeating both Scott Walker and Jeb Bush in national polls. Well, there's a lot going on the Democratic side, and it's not being talked about much. So let me bring this up here. This is on Wednesday, a new poll out from, I believe this is Quinnipiac. Yeah, Quinnipiac University poll finds that Hillary Clinton, not only lags among voters in swing states, but that she would lose or tie for the presidency against three leading Republican hopefuls if the elections were held on Wednesday in those three key swing states. This is a Quinnipiac University poll released on Wednesday finding Clinton has strikingly negative favorability ratings among voters in Virginia, Iowa, and Colorado, especially compared with where she stood in just a few months ago in the spring. The numbers come at a time when Clinton has a massive fundraising lead, relatively weak competition for the Democratic nomination, and more federal government experience than any other candidate. Even with these advantages, the poll shows Clinton may be vulnerable in states that, by all accounts, will have an outsized say in who wins the White House next year. Now, never mind how relatively weak the competition for the Democratic nomination is or isn't when it comes to Bernie. They're talking about Bernie Sanders there. Yes, he's actually making a play in those early primary states. But nationally, she still has a huge lead among Democrats. But when it comes in head to head here, Jeb Bush fares the best in Virginia, where 43% of voters view him favorably. Colorado and Iowa voters appear more skeptical of Bush. He is, however, at the top of the pack in favorability, but half or almost half of voters in those states view him unfavorably. In head-to-head matchups with Bush, Walker, and Rubio, Clinton would lose by as many as 9 points.
Wow.
9 points in Colorado and Iowa. In Virginia, where Governor Terry McAuliffe, Hillary Clinton's longtime friend and fundraiser, has endorsed her enthusiastically, Clinton would still be defeated by those Republicans, but by only 2 or 3 percentage points in Virginia, making that race too close to call at the moment. Deeper in the poll, says Washington Post, half or more than half of Virginia voters say Clinton is not honest and trustworthy and does not care about their needs and problems, though 54% say she is a strong leader. On the Democratic side, Vice President Biden does well in all three of these swing states, but he has not said yet whether he will run or not. People forget he could get in this race, Joe Biden. That would be fun. I'd love to see that. All right. But Clinton, you know, everyone is distracted by Donald Trump on the Republican side. Understandably, it's really fun. I've been enjoying it immensely. But while we have no clue, literally no clue, who the Republican Party nomination would be, the Republicans feel pretty strongly that the Democratic nominee is going to be Hillary Clinton. And they have been focusing their fire on her for a long time and trying to erode the belief that she is trustworthy and honest and so forth through the silly email scandal and other things. They've all had their eyes on that prize, and they've been working on her, wearing her down, and her favorability has dropped precipitously. Her trustworthiness has dropped precipitously over the past several months. So as much as we want to make fun of the Republicans, and Lord knows we should, they are, to some extent, doing the job they need to do. Speaking of polls and slumping in the polls, growing conservative disaffection with Pope Francis appears to be taking its toll on the once Teflon-grade popularity of the Pope here in the U.S., according to the Religion News Service. A new Gallup poll shows the pontiff's favorability rating among all Americans dropping to 59% from a 76% peak early last year. Among conservatives, however, the drop-off has been especially sharp for some reason. Can't imagine why.
Yeah, what could that possibly be?
Just 45% view Francis now favorably today, as opposed to 72% a year ago.
So since he put out his encyclical on the environment, calling on all people of goodwill to take care of the planet and our shared ecosystem that we all rely on, our only life support system in the universe, by calling for that.
Oh, they hate that.
Oh, the Republicans.
Conservatives hate that. Yeah.
Well, and I would say they're not really conservative.
Also, the decline, according to Gallup, they say that the decline may also be attributable to the Pope's denouncing of, quote, the idolatry of money.
Oh, well, that's definitely going to get Republicans and conservatives to not be happy
about that. Yes, that the Pope, the leader of the Catholic Church, is against the idolatry of money. Somehow this has made them turn against the Pope.
That's the bridge too far.
Yes. Let's see. Oh, and also attributing climate change partially to human activity and the passionate focus on income inequality. This has turned the Catholics, turned the conservatives against the Pope. But also liberal fervor has cooled as well for the Pope, according to this Gallup poll. Dropping an average of 14 points. Some observers have predicted that many who embrace the Pope's candor and his views on a range of social justice issues would temper their ardor as they realized he's not going to change church teachings on hot button issues like abortion or contraception or gay marriage. That's according to this Gallup poll, and the reason why both conservatives and liberals are turning against the Pope.
Isn't that funny?
They're not actually turning. He still has huge favorability rating. But this has happened all relatively recently, according to a Pew Research Center survey, which finds that last February, the Pope's approval rating among all Americans was at 70% and at a remarkable 90% among all Catholics. And that number has been steadily decreasing. Not with me. I still like old Papa Frank. So, okay. Anyway, a lot of disruption, a lot of polls. And speaking of that disruption, once again, in the Democratic Party, we're going to get back to that after a quick break here. And we will be joined by Tia Oso to explain what the hell happened in Phoenix over the weekend. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is your Bradcast. Hey, it's Brad, and you're listening to the Bradcast on Radio Sputnik.
It's been a long, time coming, but I know a change gon' come.
Okay, welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. We spoke on Monday on this program about what happened over the weekend at the Netroots Nation Conference in Phoenix, Arizona. Netroots is a collection of progressive activists who meet every year in one city or another and discuss progressive issues. Often have presidential candidates show up there. This weekend they had Martin O'Malley, former governor of Maryland and former mayor of Baltimore, actually, Martin O'Malley, as well as Bernie Sanders, Senator Bernie Sanders, who has been burning up the country when it comes to a turnout for his candidacy, his challenge against Hillary Clinton. In any event, both of those men were disrupted, if you will, during the during a conference, a forum, I should say, held and moderated by Jose Antonio Vargas, ostensibly concerning immigration. But it was disrupted by a group of protesters, a large group of protesters, who took over the event when Martin O'Malley was speaking and continued to hang on to it for about 15 or 20 minutes as they were demanding answers from O'Malley and trying to make their point concerning Black Lives Matter. Here's a bit of audio of one of the leaders of that protest, Tia Oso, of the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, as she came up on the stage and took the event over, in a sense.
So right now, here today, we want to take a moment at Netroots to acknowledge the lives lost every 28 hours, but specifically the Black women's lives that are lost.
How many hours? Every 100 hours?
Every 28
every
hours.
Every 28 hours.
Okay, yes. Black woman, man, or child. If we're going to call this a progressive space, we must always and unapologetically and unequivocally center Black leadership that has made every single gain of progress in this country.
You're right.
So we are going to hold this space. We are going to acknowledge the names of Black women that have died in police custody. And then, Governor O'Malley, we do have questions for you about what is your agenda going to be to make sure that Black lives do matter, and that as the leader of this nation, will you advance a racial justice agenda that will dismantle, not reform, okay, not make progress, but that will begin to dismantle structural racism in the United States?
Yes.
That was Tia Oso speaking at the Netroots Nation conference, taking it over during a very lively protest. A lot of supporters there and a lot of detractors there. A lot of folks who were upset that the forum with Governor O'Malley and then again about 15, 20 minutes later with Bernie Sanders was disrupted. Now, I described on Monday on this program how I thought, frankly, the protests were fantastic. I don't care that it upset people. I thought they were great, if only because I love democracy in action. I love when people take the stage. I love when people force their issues to the forefront. And also, by the way, this whole thing was by way of contrast with what you might have seen at a right-wing conference like CPAC or something, where protesters like that are not only tossed out, they're grabbed by goons and never heard from again. That didn't happen here. So they were in many respects embraced, brought up on the stage, and as I said, allowed to pretty much take over the forum. They weren't hustled out by security goons, and they were even allowed to stay after Martin O'Malley to do a similar disruption of Bernie Sanders. Now, that all irritated a number of otherwise good progressives, as I said, posting over at bradblog.com. Ernie Canning, who is a big Bernie Sanders fan, I'm sure he wasn't happy about Bernie being interrupted here. He left a comment. He said, "I don't think the emotional rants were fantastic, Brad. It's one thing to ask for an opportunity to ask questions and expect answers, and quite another to heckle only to hear your own chants without any desire to hear the answers. What in reality did those emotional rants accomplish?" he asks. "Certainly not the type of meaningful interactions that are essential to democracy and meaningful democratic discourse. For Bernie Sanders," he writes, "Black lives have always mattered. He was arrested in 1962 when, as a member of the Congress for Racial Equality, known as CORE, he took part in civil rights demonstrations." Another writer, Chicago Mel, says, "I believe there is a widely building national conversation on our current civil rights failings and on minority empowerment, but I felt the Netroots incident may have started the wrong conversation. Badgering one's committed political allies is hard to fathom and is usually not a very effective strategy in either the short or long run." Now, MoveOn.org came out in support of the protest, as did some of the organizers of the Netroots Nation's conference itself. So who's right? Who's wrong? And frankly, what was this protest all about? Did it accomplish what it was meant to accomplish? Want to bring on someone who may be somewhat biased on that account, but we'll find out. She was the one who led these protests at the Netroots Nation. Tia Oso is National Coordinator for Black Alliance for Just Immigration, a racial justice and migrant rights organization. She has organized campaigns such as Phoenix for Trayvon and others. She appeared earlier this week at the National Bar Association Conference out here in Los Angeles to discuss immigration issues, and she joins us on the broadcast now. Tia Oso, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Brad.
Thank you for coming. Now, did you accomplish what you had hoped to do with your protests of Martin O'Malley and Bernie Sanders at Netroots Nation? And what did you hope to accomplish with that?
So thank you for having me on and opening up a dialogue about this in the kind of aftermath, right, of the action that we took on Saturday. So First off,
sure,
I'll take the opportunity to say that the action is a demonstration under the theme of Say Her Name, which is a national campaign introduced by Black Youth Project 100, in order to uplift victims of police violence that are Black women. And so the context of the Netroots Town Hall was chosen as the site, right, and moment of the action, but it in no way, shape, or form was a protest against former Governor O'Malley or Senator Sanders.
Well,
having said that,
yeah,
I do think that we definitely accomplished what we set out to do in that we were able to hold the space. We were able to share the news of Black women that were killed in police custody, as well as express our anguish and our grief and our outrage about this really epidemic, right, of police violence that's happening in our communities, as well as to have the opportunity to present these questions directly to these potential presidential candidates to have them answer to us, you know, in this state of emergency, what is it that they plan to do about it?
And how do you feel how did you rate the response from Martin O'Malley and then from Bernie Sanders?
So I'm not a political analyst to know how exactly to read it. I can share from my personal perspective that I was very surprised at how unprepared they seemed to answer the question and really respond and empathize and connect with what it is that we were saying. I mean, we are at a progressive space conference. This was my first time attending Netroots, but from Netroots veterans, I learned that there's always some sort of a demonstration or disruption during the town hall. So the fact that they seem to be very caught off guard, I personally was really dismayed that folks who are seeking the highest office in the land aren't ready to take on these really tough issues. And for, you know, my community and my generation, really the primary issue affecting us today.
Do you think that they weren't ready to take on these issues, or do you think they just weren't ready for, you know, being challenged in that way, that they didn't expect to be challenged? They were coming to what they thought was a generally, you know, friendly crowd there of progressives at Netroots. I mean, Bernie Sanders, now you heard me at the top here. I think what you guys did is fantastic. So don't get me wrong, but I do want to challenge you a little bit. I mean, Bernie Sanders has, you know, for 50 years, a powerful record on civil rights and human rights, you know, going way back. It seems like he's prepared to deal with this issue. Maybe was surprised that you guys showed up and interrupted. And I agree, he was quite dismissive in some sense and clearly frustrated. But are you really concerned that Bernie Sanders is not on the same page with the Black Lives Matter movement? Or do you think he was just caught off guard here?
I think that it's a little, several things happening at one time, right? So, number one, again, from what has been told to me, because it was my first Netroots, there's always a disruption, there's always some type of confrontation of some sort during the town hall. So, had either candidate's staff been very prepared for the space, I don't think that they should have been too shocked that they addressed in some type of way, especially with the time of the event being the town hall, right? Also, I think that Senator Sanders' record, his policy record, is not what was in question at all. We're talking about moving forward. We're talking about right now what's happening. What is it that both of the candidates were prepared to do, and also to respond to our pain? We wanted to call the question in a very urgent way, especially because Sandra Bland had just been found hanging in police custody in Texas that Sunday, and up until that moment, neither candidate had addressed it.
I gotcha. One of the comments that elicited a huge response, I think we got a clip here, Des, the short version of this, was Governor O'Malley when he responded to what you guys were talking about, to Black Lives Matter. He sort of repeated his record as as the mayor of Baltimore and as governor of Maryland, what he did, what he felt he did to deal with racism there. And then he made a comment that all lives matter. I want to play this clip and then get your response to it. And so you can explain to me how he got this wrong.
Every life matters. And that is why this issue is so important. Black lives matter. White lives matter. All lives matter. Black lives matter. White lives matter. All lives matter.
That was Governor O'Malley responding to the responding to the protests, saying all lives matter, white lives, black lives matter, white lives matter. I think Hillary Clinton at one point gave a similar response. What's wrong with that response, Tia Oso, to the Black Lives Matter cry by saying all lives matter, including white lives?
I think that there isn't anything wrong with, in the course of expecting yourself for you to affirm all human lives. I think that what he got wrong about it was the context and the context of the question. We're talking about structural racism. And so to equivocate or dismiss or erase, right, the Black Lives Matter, you know, how are you going to address and make sure that Black Lives Matter in the context of, you know, race and systemic racism in the United States, then to say, you know, to try to shift and be skip over the actual significance of what's happening in Black communities, that is the mistake. It's not, you know, just the saying of the word. That's not what it is. It's just skipping over any erasure of the actual issue that we're addressing at the moment. It's very similar to if you were at, say, you know, a rally around, you know, the AIDS epidemic, to also get up and say, well, you know, what we really need to be talking about, right, is obesity. That's also important. Imagine how people would feel.
So it's not that white lives don't matter. It's just that that kind of response just cancels out the argument, cancels out the case that you're trying to make, it sounds like.
It ends the conversation,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Of course, I stand for the human dignity and rights of all people.
Mm-hmm. Now,
at no point in time would it be acceptable to me for anybody on the planet to be subject to especially state violence,
mm-hmm.
and it just be dismissed and ignored at no point in time.
Now, I know that a lot of the critics, and again, these are progressives with whom you probably agree far more than you disagree. A lot of the critics, you know, I've seen have said, well, you know, why are you protesting Democrats? It's Republicans, the Republican candidates. There's 27 of them out there. You know, why aren't you protesting them? Or is that either pointless or counterproductive somehow to protest? Is it more productive to bring this fight home to progressives and to the Democratic Party?
So I have not tried to focus too much on, like, you know, a lot of the negative comments and backlash, because I don't want to take it personally.
Mm-hmm.
I know that the direct confrontation, especially in a room full of some political candidate supporters, right, definitely can elicit a reaction, some of it very emotional and almost like reflexively reactionary. So I understand, you know, folks are emotional in this context, but I don't think that it's valid at all to try to say that the networks wasn't the appropriate venue to do direct action, you know, in the sense of Black lives. African Americans and Black immigrants have been adversely affected under policies by Republicans as well as Democrats. I think that even the fact that we have right now an African American president and President Obama,
mm-hmm.
and we're seeing this huge surge in epidemic, right, of police violence and, you know, some of the largest mass movement around racial justice at any point in time should give us a pretty healthy understanding and context about the fact that at no point in time nobody should be let off the hook because they generally espouse beliefs that are favorable to your cause. I think that what's happening in our communities is evidence enough itself, and the fact that we have to really force this moral issue and this confrontation in order for it to even be acknowledged, right, challenges what we mean by when we say progressive space. It's what it takes for us all to be on the same team, quote unquote, in the same side. It's for me to sit and silently suffer and die, then I just don't agree that that is what a progressive space is, actually. And I think it was 100% appropriate for us to disrupt.
I've got just a minute or two left, Tia Oso, since you mentioned Barack Obama, and never mind a presidential candidate and the lack of power that they may or may not have, but, you know, what of Barack Obama? What hard policies would you like to see either by the president brought forward, or I suppose by the presidential candidates, in this case Martin O'Malley, Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, all of the folks on the Republican side? In other words, what can a politician actually do to address the systemic racism that you are talking about? Are there policies that can be implemented that will change this equation, change this trajectory, as you'd like to see it, Tia?
Definitely. Thank you for asking that. So I think that in response to the movement for Black Lives and the courageous, you know, Black men and women and communities that are really, you know, demanding action and change, we're already seeing a shift and a focus, and we're determined to continue. We've seen President Obama respond by sending the Department of Justice, right, to investigate cases on the ground. We've seen him create the task force on 21st century policing, and then we've seen him take the executive action that he could take in addressing some of the military equipment that is distributed at the local level, right? So those are responses to me that are very kind of measured, but actual, you know, movement that you can validate and you can review and see if it makes a difference. I think that as far as candidates are concerned, everyone is in the midst of developing their policy positions. I think that one of the things that everyone can do is to really get educated about the issues, and then also in places and times and spaces where they have the opportunity to talk to people who are being affected, to sit down and do that and build a relationship. I know that politics is a lot of different things happening at one time, but I do notice that when it's campaign season, you see people out on the ground in communities that where it's important, shaking hands, sitting down, listening, you know, and really, you know, affirming and validating people's experiences. And so I think that it would be really good to have not just the show, okay, so not just the demonstration of, you know, going out of Black communities and shaking hands and taking pictures, but both really sitting down and listening to these communities and then also researching the policies that will help to advance agenda to make some of these corrections. And one of the ways that budgets, for example, are set is very racialized. A lot of the ways things like redistricting and voting districts are drawn. A lot of different factors are coming into play leading up to, you know, the violence that we see happening against Black communities at the hands of police. So I think it's a complicated issue that deserves and definitely needs to be invested in and evaluated, especially by politicians and folks who make our, you know, make the rules that govern our society.
It seems like we've seen a real shift, and I've been talking about this over the past few weeks, you know, with all of these, not just the protests, but the videos of these killings, these shootings and so forth that have come out. Obviously, they are, you know, terrible, horrible, grotesque. But the fact that they are coming out, the fact that we are seeing them with such regularity, I realize it's somewhat counterintuitive because we're seeing, you know, so much violence against the Black community. But on the other hand, we're finally seeing it. And it feels to me like there's a change happening, and that we're seeing actually now for the first time in many years a real shift, along with the, you know, the rise of the Black Lives Matters movement. Do you agree that's the case, or is the media and the politicians and everyone else still so horribly behind in dealing with the facts of this issue as you see it? Are you hopeful or discouraged at this point, I guess, is the question.
I'm always going to remain hopeful. I believe that people motivated by love and even protest and taking action, right, is rooted in hope. It's rooted in the fact that we believe that things can change. I think that it's heartbreaking to me and very hurtful to me that it takes people seeing explicitly the brutalization and murder of people to even begin to talk about these issues. And it reminds me, you know, as a student and studying of the civil rights movement, of how when across America, you know, the news reports would show, you know, the protesters in the South being attacked by dogs, you know, sprayed with high-power water hoses, but that is when the conversation started to shift about maybe there is an issue in the South and maybe something does need to be done in the highest levels of our government about what's happening in Black communities. And so I think it's very similar and it is definitely an echo of ways that progress has been made in the past. But quite honestly and personally, as an African-American woman who grew up and is dealing with systemic racism and violence and the results of it in my family and in my community, I think that when we say these things, our words should be enough. We talk a lot. There are a lot of town halls. We have NAACP and the Urban League at the national level having these conversations all the time. Reports are issued, and the fact that it takes, you know, this almost a spectacle of Black suffering for people to even have their hearts moved is heartbreaking to me.
It is, but I thank you, Tia Oso, for raising hell about it in any forum necessary. Tia Oso, National Coordinator of Black Alliance for Just Immigration. You can find her on the Twitters at Tia @BlackAlliance_Oso. You can find Black Alliance at BAGI Tweet on the Twitters, and of course on their website, blackalliance.org. Tia, great talking to you today. Keep up the good work. Keep raising hell.
Great talking to you as well. Thank you for the support.
You bet. All right. You know, it's amazing how many people are upset by democracy. You know, this is the way things should be. We should have a scrappy democracy. We shouldn't have, you know, parties all marching in lockstep. Lord knows they're not doing that on the Republican side. Well, actually, they sort of are. Other than Donald Trump, they're all kind of lockstep. They have different flavors of the exact same thing. But listen, I am happy to see a robust fight on the progressive side, not just between, you know, Hillary and Bernie Sanders, but people holding their feet to the fire, whether it's Bernie, whether it's Hillary, whether it's Martin O'Malley. It's what democracy's about, man. We don't need a coronation here of Hillary Clinton. And we don't need, by the way, a coronation of Bernie Sanders either. Hold feet to the fire. That's what these campaigns are supposed to be about. And then, yes, answer back, as Zaid Jilani did. 20 examples of Bernie Sanders' powerful record on civil and human rights since the 1950s. You can read that over at Alternate. Yes, he has been very good on these issues. Anyway, let's have it out. I'm all in favor of it. Take a quick break, and we'll come back with much more, and perhaps one of the reasons why we have such trouble having it out in this country. Money and Politics. Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast. Stay tuned. Hey, this is Brad, and you're listening to the Bradcast on Radio Sputnik. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. So we're talking about, as long as it's beat up on Democrats Day here today on the broadcast, which, frankly, it should be every day.
Sure.
But in any event, you know, as long as we're talking about the difference between what it is that the candidates, you know, are campaigning on and what it is that the American public wants, whether it's the rank and file public, whether it's, you know, a more specific interest like Tia Oso that we were speaking to, who has very specific issues of concern to her, we have this huge gap between what it is that candidates do, what it is that elected officials do, and what it is that the people want. And what explains that difference? Well, probably money. Ernie Canning, again, our legal analyst over at bradblog.com, has written about this, has talked about the democracy deficit, as Noam Chomsky calls it, and, you know, the difference between what the politicians do and what it is that the people want. And I'll give you some numbers on that in a moment, but let's look at some of those numbers and where we are in this particular 2016 race. I was trying to get to this last week. We ended the quarter, and so the candidates had to report to the FEC how they did on fundraising. Well, Hillary Clinton hauled in $47.5 million in the first 3 months of her official campaign, beating both Jeb Bush, who raised $11.4 million, and Bernie Sanders, who racked up $15.2 million. She had more than 250,000 donors. That's a lot of donors. It's impressive. But she reported raising just $8 million of that $47 million from small donors who gave less than $200 or less. So 16.8% of her total came from small donors. All the rest came from people who donated the maximum amount, who could afford to donate the maximum amount. In this case, $2,600, or from big donors who bundled things together. I'll get to that in a moment. Now, I don't know about you. I don't have $2,600 to give to any candidate for anything ever. So, you know, most Americans, they'll give $200 or less. She received, as I said, 16.8% from that group. Not bad. Jeb Bush raised only 3% of his campaign cash from small donors of $200 or less. But Bernie Sanders blew them both away. He took in $10.4 million, 68%. 68% of his war chest came from small donors who gave $200 or less.
Wow, that's a massive difference. So you said
it's huge.
Jeb
yeah.
was at 3% from small donors.
Right.
Hillary at 16%.
See, Hillary at 16%, and she was crowing about that this was an impressive number, and I guess it is 16%. But yeah, he's not even 68% came from small donors
for Bernie Sanders. Wow.
Yeah. The bulk of Clinton's campaign funds came from this wealthy class of elite donors, according to Mother Jones. And let's see, Bush's campaign raised more than 80% of its cash from those rich, from those really, really wealthy donors. In 2014, roughly 0.04% of Americans were able to make that maximum donation, that $2,600 donation.
Wait.
0.04. That's less than
one-half of 1% of Americans.
Right. Yeah. So we're talking about a tiny number, and yet this is 80% of what Bush raised, Jeb Bush, came from them, and 64% of what Clinton raised came from them. Also, it should be noticed here that 40 registered lobbyists bundled money over $2 million to Hillary Clinton. By way of comparison, Bush's campaign listed the names of 8 registered lobbyists who bundled $228,000 for his campaign. Of course, he got in, I believe, a bit later. So there'll be more from lobbyists for Jeb Bush. Bet your bottom dollar. In the meantime, Bernie Sanders had 0 registered lobbyists fundraising on his behalf. Now, how does that money, you know, we hear about this all the time, money in politics, these wealthy donors. How does that affect policy on a practical level? Well, Sean McElwee of Demos, we had him on the show a few weeks ago. He pointed out this chart. This looks like it's from from Demos. The jobs and income, the policy preferences of affluent people versus the general public. So let me give you a couple of examples. And these are relative, you know, policies you would think pretty much everyone in America would agree with. Okay, government must see that no one is without food, clothing, or shelter. Doesn't seem to me to be particularly controversial.
That people
yeah.
should have food.
Food, clothing,
children
and shelter,
should not
right.
go hungry.
But I guess, you know, that government is they're responsible to see to that. Well, 43% of the wealthy believe that. Just 43%. On the other hand, the general public in favor of that, 68%. 68% agree the government must see that no one is without food, clothing, or shelter, but just 43% of the rich. Minimum wage should be high enough so that no family with a full-time worker falls below the official poverty line. Well, only 40% of rich people think that. 78% of the general public believe that the minimum wage should be high enough. You got someone working in your family, you shouldn't be in poverty, says 78% of the public, but only 40% of the rich people. The government should provide a decent standard of living for the unemployed. 50% of Americans believe that, just 23% of the wealthy. Here's a stunning number. The government in Washington ought to see to it that everyone who wants work can find a job. 68%, huge majority, 68% of the government, of the American public agrees. Just 19% of the wealthy.
Wow, so you're supposed to pull yourself up by your bootstraps without any boots or any straps.
Correct.
Wow.
Yes, of course. And of course, mind you, you know, these are wealthy people. They've already climbed the ladder, and what is it? They're pulling up
the ladder behind
pulling
them.
The hell with everyone else. The earned income tax credit should be increased rather than decreased or kept the same. 49% of the American public agree. Just 13% of the wealthy agree. And finally, the federal government should provide jobs for everyone able and willing to work who cannot find a job in private employment. 53% of the public agree, just 8% of the wealthy. It's almost as if the wealthy thinks government should do much less, as if the wealthy doesn't need government to do anything for them, so the hell with everyone else.
Almost as if.
Yeah. Almost as if. All right, one more point here before we go. We had Dr. Yosef Brody on the program earlier this week talking about the American Psychological Association's collusion with the Bush administration concerning torture after 9/11, torture by the CIA and the Department of Defense, and how the APA, the top medical psychological association in the country, in the world, actually, was in the, you know, in cahoots with the Bush administration to pretend that the torture that was going on, these so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, that they were safe and effective, and that you didn't have anything to worry about from a psychological standpoint. Turns out that was complete and utter nonsense, and some folks at the very top of the APA knew this, and they were thrown in with the Bush administration, telling them what they wanted to hear, and there was this huge new 540-page report about this. Well, in the conversation with Dr. Yosef Brody on this show, you can go back and listen to it. It was great. He had mentioned at one point that the torture is still going on. And we didn't get to get into that. And he sent me some email after the interview, and he said, hey, yeah, both you and I sort of glossed over this, but in fact, the torture has not stopped, even though the torture policy that was the Bush and Cheney were pulling off after 9/11, that policy has stopped. But he says torture still continues today, even under Barack Obama. He wrote a letter to the to New Yorker. It's in the issue this month, the July issue, the one that has Donald Trump doing a belly flop on the cover. So his letter appeared there, and he wrote that, unfortunately, it seems unlikely that people who authorized and engaged in torture under the U.S. flag will ever be held accountable. A more urgent problem is that neither President Obama's 2009 executive order to stop torture, nor the Senate's recent passage of the McCain-Feinstein Amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act has completely closed torture loopholes. The 2006 Army Field Manual, in effect, the guiding standard for interrogations, lies outside the norms of international law and practice. Beyond the manual's permission to create and manipulate phobias and engender hopelessness and helplessness, its Appendix M allows for the extended use of solitary confinement and sleep deprivation in cases involving unlawful combatants. The American public may not find these tactics as shocking as waterboarding and rectal feeding, but the United Nations and human rights organizations such as Amnesty International describe them as torture or cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. Many victims are known to suffer chronic trauma and psychosis or to become suicidal. The McCain-Feinstein Amendment codifies a ban on some of the more lurid interrogation methods, but between the lines, official authorization of torture remains. That's according to Dr. Yosef Brody of the Psychologists for Social Responsibility, our guest earlier in the week, who says, yeah, torture is still going on, even under President Obama. Thought that was worth noting. Okay, my thanks today to our producer, as always, Desi Doyen, to our booking goddess, Cynthia Cohn, and to my guest, Tia Oso of BlackAlliance.org. If you missed any portion of the program, you can always download it at bradblog.com or over at iTunes, where we hope you will give us a swell review to make the program easier for others to find. You can and should find and follow us on the Facebooks and the Twitters at The Brad Blog. You can also email me. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. We'll be back with you, same Brad time, same Brad channel tomorrow. Until then, you can find me at bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.